Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Does a BBC program deliberately distort the truth about child abuse and the church? England's cardinal speaks out. Schools prepare to reopen in Lebanon amidst tens of thousands of unexploded bombs. And is it euthanasia or assisted suicide? The debate rages in Italy. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. The head of the Catholic bishops in England and Wales has written a formal letter of protest to the director of the BBC following a documentary that aired this weekend that accuses Pope Benedict of covering up child abuse by priests. Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor says the program Panorama is clearly attempting to distort the truth and defame Pope Benedict himself. The program alleges that the church and the former Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger had a deliberate policy of sheltering perpetrators of abuse and silencing victims.
But I think what particularly upset the bishops and particularly upset me was the fact that this program was very shoddily researched. It tried to link, because of documents which were issued by the Vatican, badly interpreted, to try and fix blame on Pope Benedict. We thought this was not only unfair, but mischievous, as well as untrue.
What do you think was the intention of the people who were behind this program?
Well, clearly the intention was to highlight child abuse, yes, but also somehow, again, to blame the Catholic Church. And if you can blame in any way the leader of the Catholic Church, the Pope, then it gets a higher rating. And I think that also was the intention of the makers of this program. Let's relate all this to Pope Benedict, and this will become more of a sensation.
Now, in your letter, you ask if within the BBC there is what you call a persistent bias against the Catholic Church. Do you feel that is the case?
Well, I've said that I think there is. Now, one has to be very careful. BBC do very good programmes. And I, indeed, in my letter, I noted that I congratulated the BBC on their coverage of the death of Pope John Paul and the election of Pope Benedict. But there is no doubt, I think, that many people, impartial people, will look at some of the programmes that are put out by the BBC and think there is an impartiality here, impartiality in the sense that they don't give the whole picture. For instance, there was a programme about death in Africa, when the BBC allowed a programme that seemed to give the impression that the Catholic teaching contributed to death of people in Africa, without saying anything about the fact that over a quarter of all health care, and particularly for AIDS victims, is given by the Catholic Church in Africa. There are all sorts of things which were totally unbalanced. That's just one example. There are others. And if the Director General asks me to elicit what kind of programs I'm thinking of, I will tell him. But it's also not just about what the programs are, but also, in a sense, what they are not. In other words, there are a number of matters concerning the church which I believe the BBC should have made a contribution. Let me give you an example. World Youth Day in Cologne was hardly mentioned. Here were, you know, half a million young people. Great event. Is hardly touched on by the BBC. The same about the Holy Father's journey to his home country and his visit to Auschwitz. Hardly mentioned. Or the anniversary of Pope John Paul's time is still the jubilee as Pope. All these things were just not dealt with. And I just feel there's a partiality, as I say, not only what the BBC does in some programmes, and what the BBC doesn't do.
So you're saying there should perhaps be better communication between the church and the BBC and perhaps other areas of the media in the UK. I mean, do you feel people on the whole are open to listening to your suggestions? Would you expect any response from the Director General or anybody else regarding this affair, for example?
I haven't had a response as yet, but I wouldn't expect one. He will have just received the letter. But I think a positive response would be to say, well, we're very willing to be in touch with you and those who work for you in the media, and especially with regard to the BBC, to see if there is a truth in what you say, and if so, how we can correct it.
There was no contact from the BBC to the Catholic Office for the Protection of Children and Vulnerable Adults in the making of this programme at all, was there?
Well, this is what particularly troubled us. It was alleged in the programme that an approach had been made to the Vatican to comment, but I'd like to know more details about that. Sometimes I'm quite sure the Vatican Office decides not to cooperate with the programme, and for good reasons. But I thought it was very, very wrong for the British Broadcasting Corporation, the BBC, not to have asked anybody from within the Catholic Church to comment on this programme, and particularly on those aspects of it which touched Pope Benedict and documents which only the Catholic Church itself could have given a proper interpretation.
Do you feel that in Britain as a whole, the work of that office, the Catholic Office for the Protection of Children and Vulnerable Adults, do you feel that work is respected and that there is a sense that the problem is being dealt with seriously?
I've no doubt about that. People have acknowledged that the work in Britain, resulting from a commission I set up nearly 6 years ago, Lord Nolan's committee, and his recommendations accepted by all the bishops, have now resulted in the fact that I think child protection issues are dealt with in Britain in a way that's, I think, widely respected. And indeed, even by people of other faiths and fellow Christians are acknowledged as a model in their field now. Of course, everything can be improved, and that we don't say that there's not yet more to be done. But I do think that our regulations, our recommendations, our rules for child protection are being kept and observed. And as a result, the protection of children is definitely a priority in these countries.
Now, this programme was built around the grief, the anger, the trauma of victims of abuse. What else can the church or should the church be doing to try and help victims of this kind of abuse?
It's a very delicate and important matter. I mean, how can we help victims? And I know that dioceses and our conference are still discussing this matter and taking some action. We have a consultant in my own diocese who actually is someone to whom a victim can approach with a view to getting the right advice and help. Sometimes the victims of this terrible crime, not best to go to a priest or a bishop, but you need someone, as it were, independent, but who will be confident and trained enough to be able to help them. So I think the church in Britain is looking at ways in which we can help victims in a way that's most appropriate for them.
And our thanks there to Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor of Westminster, speaking there to Philippa Hitchin. School starts next week for hundreds of thousands of children in Lebanon. The beginning of this school year was delayed after the 34-day war this summer that pitted Israeli troops against Hezbollah militants in southern Lebanon. Well, about 1 million people who had fled the fighting in south Lebanon have since returned home to dig out the rubble and rebuild their houses. But one deadly legacy of the war will remain for some time to come. UN experts say Israeli jets dropped up to 1 million cluster bombs on South Lebanon, many just in the last 2 days of the war. And those deadly bombs continue to kill and maim civilians well after the last guns fell silent. As schools prepare to open, authorities are doing their best to clear roads and schools of unexploded bombs, but the task is proving to be enormous. Owen Murray of the Ireland-based Catholic aid agency Trocare recently toured the devastation in South Lebanon.
A lot of the schools and a lot of the public buildings in general are covered in unexploded ordnance. In the last sort of 48 to 72 hours of the war, Israel dropped 70% of the total unexploded ordnance in the form of cluster bombs. And they literally litter the schools. They cover schools and public buildings, which means that many schools won't be able to take the kids back. And already the schools have been delayed. They should have started in September. So the schools have their problems. And then you have many of the private schools where people would have had an income to pay previously to give their children a good education or a better education. Now those people don't have the option to pay fees. And those kids, those teachers and those schools are in a particular set of problems as well.
The director of Lebanon's National Caritas Network, George Khoury, told me Catholic schools, considered some of the best in the country, are facing huge financial difficulties as a result of the war, on top of an already strapped economy that was struggling to recover from the country's previous conflict that ended in 1990.
Financially, the parents and the population cannot handle it because of the economic crisis which was prevailing in the country before and during and after now. So school fees are a problem. Even, stationery books and registration fees are a problem. The Saudi Arabia has come to, cover up the cost of the registration fees in all public schools. But, as far as the Christian community is concerned, we are much, much more depending on the private Catholic private schools because of the quality of education. The quality of education in the public sector is not of a standard. So for the quality of education, most of the people go to the private schools, and the Catholic school in Lebanon is very prominent. Private Catholic schools, it doesn't go any over $1,500 or $2,000 per year. For a minimum salary of $200 per month, you can know what it represents, paying school fees for two children or three children in a family who gets the minimum salary of $200 per month.
While the financial worries of families are nonetheless important, it is the cluster bombs that pose the most immediate problem to the reopening of schools in the South. UN experts say Israel has not responded to repeated UN requests to hand over detailed information about the cluster bomb strikes, making the task of clearing the bomblets far more difficult. Fired by cannon or dropped from an aircraft, the cluster bombs release hundreds of smaller bomblets in mid-air that are supposed to explode upon impact. However, the failure rate in Lebanon was around 30% to 40%. The bomblets are half the size of a can of soda, and they're lying on people's houses, gardens, rooftops, on the street and on farmland. Habouda Aoun, coordinator of Lebanon's Landmine Resource Center, told Susie Hodges that children are particularly at risk because they are attracted to unfamiliar objects and the bomblets are often brightly colored.
Every day we are having between 4 and 5 people injured by cluster bombs. These could be children as well as adults. The children are being injured either because they were playing in front of their houses or sometimes inside the house, or just because they were sitting under the tree and something from above their head came down and exploded, because we have these cluster bombs that have now this ribbon and they are hanging on the trees. And we have the farmers who are trying to make use of their land again and are trying to prepare for the harvest season of olives, of bananas, of oranges, and they are getting injured as well.
Now, is this problem preventing many people from returning to their homes after the war ended?
It is a serious problem, presenting a serious obstacle to the return of people in the houses and in the villages where they used to be. Yes.
Now, are you doing a public information campaign to alert the population to the risks, or are there still some people who are simply not aware and, as you say, coming up against this problem?
Yeah, the first day of the ceasefire, actually, we were ready to be with the people in their returning places, where we, with a TV campaign, with a radio campaign, with a written media campaign, and we were trying to be at all the entry points to the south, distributing leaflets, showing to the people the kind of danger they might encounter while they are returning. But despite all of all this effort, we are having every day these injuries, because the problem is so huge. So we started community work at the level of the village, at the level of even households in the village, in order to be very close to the people and to alert them to the problem.
Aoun says authorities have had to close some schools because it is simply too dangerous to send children to them.
So children are really finding a difficult time in dealing or understanding the extent of the danger they are facing. Because one of them, when I was talking to him about the danger of the cluster bomb, he told me, look, isn't it like a good that we take for water with us to the school? It's not a cluster bomb. It is just a gift from the sky. We have to collect it and get it with us to the school. And then his friend just interferes to say, listen, but also they are saying that there is no school because we are unable to reach it because it is damaged or because it needs restoration. Oh, no, it's not a gift. Then they continue as such and not knowing really the extent of the danger.
Is it fair to say that there's perhaps thousands or even tens of thousands of children, of young children, who are basically being confined to their homes and who are not allowed to play outside at the moment because of this problem?
Yes, that is correct.
And as you say, it must be incredibly frustrating for them, and they must be driving their parents crazy.
Yeah, because cluster bombs are found amazingly even on the trees or in the gardens. These used to be the places where children play. So they are unable to go jump on the trees, and they are unable to go in their garden. And their garden was something that is very nice, but that is very safe, that is joyful. So they are unable to associate the danger to a place that used to be a peaceful, joyful place. And this is really a problem.
And how long will it take to clear the area of all this unexploded ordnance?
We have confusing information about this. Some people said that in order to have a normal or almost normal life in the villages again, it would take almost 2 years to start with, to get rid of the cluster bomb. But other official information says that now the problem has turned back to be 10 years or more. We all believe that these cluster bombs should be banned, and we are having a national effort call for an international ban on the use of cluster bombs, joining as such effort with the international community and the cluster coalition community committee working on the banning of the use of cluster bombs.
Abouda Aoun is coordinator of Lebanon's Landmine Resource Center. When does life end, and what makes a life worth living? These are just some of the hundreds of questions that Italians have been pondering in a public debate that erupted when a severely handicapped man publicly asked permission to die. 60-year-old Pier Giorgio Welby wrote to the Italian president Giorgio Napolitano saying he wanted the right to die in dignity and that Italians should have the same access to euthanasia as people in some other European countries. The Italian president has added flame to the fire by calling for a parliamentary debate on euthanasia. Welby has suffered much of his life from muscular dystrophy, but the disease has progressed to the point that he can now no longer move from his bed. He breathes through a respirator, is fed through a feeding tube, and communicates via a voice synthesizer. But is this a case of euthanasia, as most of the press here are depicting it? Or is it really a case of assisted suicide? I asked the Dean of Theology of the Pontifical Athenaeum Regina Apostolorum, Father Tom Williams.
Well, I think that this case itself is clearly a case of assisted suicide. It's a person who is asking to be killed, a person who is not in imminent danger of death, who is not even terminally ill. Granted, it is a fine distinction. It's a fine line between assisted suicide and euthanasia. They're actually very similar. But in this case, technically, it would be considered assisted suicide.
The Catholic Catechism says to discontinue medical procedures that are burdensome, dangerous, extraordinary, or disproportionate to the expected outcome can be legitimate. So, would feeding tubes and respirators fall into the category of such extraordinary measures?
No, I think clearly they wouldn't, for two reasons. First of all, Pope John Paul II, 3 years ago, specifically talked about hydration and nutrition, in other words, feeding tubes, as being always nowadays considered ordinary means of care for patients. Feeding food and drink administered either through a tube or by other means is always ordinary care in the first place. Secondly, when you talk about the proportionate outcome, for example, if you're giving someone a certain drug which may extend that person's life, you know, another month, but with great pain, that's considered disproportionate. Whereas something that will continue their life indefinitely is never considered disproportionate. It's not a question of pulling a person completely out so they're playing baseball again in a few weeks. It's a question of, you know, if this continues their life in a very stable way, that's usually considered proportionate.
Okay. Well, technology is so advanced today. Doctors can keep the heart beating even though a person may be brain dead, which is the universally accepted definition of death. But here we have a man who is conscious and thinking, and apart from the fact that his body won't do what he wants it to do, he's nowhere near dying. If this man, if we were, you know, 30, 40 years ago, if this man were left to his own devices and had no one to assist him, he would most likely have already died. So is there anything wrong with just taking away these mechanical apparatus that keep him alive?
Well, there are cases, to be sure, where a person who without some sort of really extraordinary and sometimes very, very invasive mechanisms would just naturally die. And there are cases where it's legitimate to take those away. Again, in it's never the case of nutrition and hydration, but it is the case of certain machines that literally take the place of other bodily functions. In this case, it's a little bit harder to justify simply because the person is fully conscious and operational, if you will. The body, as you said, doesn't do what he wants, but he is, you know, fully aware of what's going on. Clearly, it's not just a question of keeping a person alive in a comatose state, but a person who is fully functional. And there, I think you have to. It's a very tough case to make that it would legitimately remove these machines.
Here is a man who cannot move. He's a prisoner in his bed. He must rely on someone else's help, their generosity, to be fed, changed, cleaned, what have you. And though he doesn't appear to be in pain, his quality of life is obviously very low, so low that he wants to end it. He says that not so long ago his quality of life was much better. He could sit up and interact with people, but he's no longer even able to do that anymore. So to what extent should the quality of life be considered in the decision of whether or not to pull the plug?
Well, as you know, quality of life is an extremely subjective term. You can speak with, you know, teenagers going through a little bit of adolescent angst who will tell you that their quality of life is zero, that they would like to end it all. People who get depressed will say, because my husband left me, my life is no longer. There are plenty of cases in life where, whatever the reason, it could be physical, it could be mental, it could be psychological, where we say, you know, I just really don't want to live. This isn't worth it. And other people in my exact same situation would be saying, hey, life is really worth living. And there isn't an objective standard where you can say, you know, this life is no longer worth living. I think it's a very dangerous road to go down and say at some point human life isn't worth living. What is it that makes human life worth living? What is it that gives it value? And I think there, you know, the Christian, and not only Christian, but the classical understanding of the dignity of human life as such and the sanctity of human life, is very important for our generation to uphold that.
then quality of life, let's say, could be considered a state of mind in a certain sense. Is there such a thing as being able to turn an illness like this into something positive?
Well, I think, again, there are so many cases of that, and so many cases of people who went through a time of depression or a time where they wanted to end it all, were supported by friends and family, and later on said, thank God that I didn't do what I really wanted to do at that time. And I think it's very important for us as a society to send a message to people who are sick, people who are infirm, people who feel useless, that you are important, you're valuable to us. We support you. It's a joy for us to be able to serve you in this situation and not make them feel like a burden. And as soon as you open the door, as soon as you say, you know, there's always this other option. You know, let's make euthanasia available. Let's make it a legal option. There's a huge pressure there for people who already feel useless to take that out because they're feeling like a burden. And we as a society can't permit that. It's a wrong thing to do. And to take one case of a person who's saying right now, I would like to end it, and try to universalize that into a law which would have very, very deleterious consequences for many other people is really bad thinking. And I think that a danger of our very utilitarian society that we have now, that people are worth what they produce, once a person stops producing in any external way, then they easily start feeling useless. And in that moment of doubt is when they most need the support of the community to say, no, your life is not without value. It's of great value to all of us.
Quite frankly, a situation like this imposes huge financial burdens on families. It's one thing to talk about it from our comfortable position here in Europe, where there are national health systems where you're covered for care like this. But in places like the United States, everything is private. So should governments be, you know, morally responsible for caring for people at the end of their lives?
Well, I think there needs to be a lot of debate because the actual hows, whens, whys need to be discussed. The fact of the matter is that society has the obligation. Now, whether that means that society has the obligation to give tax credits to groups, whether it means that there have to be a different, you know, civil society set up to do this, or whether it should fall to the state, the federal government, that's not a question that the church would have any specific opinion on. What it would say is that society, we, the community of human beings that live in a particular area, have to do something about this. In practice, how that's done, it very well may be responsibility of the state, but it's something that needs a lot of debate.
Cardinal Javier Lozano Barragan, who heads up the Vatican Council for Healthcare here, came out with a statement on this case of Mr. Welby, saying that euthanasia amounts to murder and therefore it can never be allowed. He also invited Catholic parliamentarians here in Italy to act with what he called consistency. Now, how concerned are people within the church here in Italy that this case could set a precedent in euthanasia legislation? You did start to talk about that a minute ago.
The church is very concerned, and there's a universal principle in law, which is tough cases make bad law. If you take a very extreme case where people's emotions are very keyed up because you see this person suffering, and you try to create a universal law around an extreme case, that law is not going to be a good law. And I think that our tendency in modern society to look at individual cases and to make them into these big, you know, cause célèbre, I think is a very dangerous thing for legislation. The one thing I also want to say about the church element, I think we have to be very careful. You know, every single report on this Welby case talks about the church's position. The church condemns this sort of thing. The church is against euthanasia, as if it were really a religious question, and it's not. And I think that inevitably when we say the church forbids this, people think, you know, this is simply just another obstacle, another hurdle to be overcome in the path to the complete emancipation of civil society from the church. And I think that's bad. It's not a church-state issue, as if the church is in favor and the state is against. It's a question of human dignity. And I think all people of goodwill, whether they're believing or not, have to stand together on this.
Father Tom Williams is Dean of Theology at the Pontifical Athenaeum Regina Apostolorum here in Rome. And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.